So I know you can also hear my breathing, so that's not too distracting. I'll try not to breathe. Different kind of meditation object for you. So we're kind of entering the midsection of this retreat, and I want to just kind of say, okay, in that first couple of days, we were really looking at the overview of the gradual path from a couple of different perspectives. And then we started to talk in more detail about purifying virtue by body, speech, and mind, and a little bit about livelihood. And tonight I want to talk about sense restraint, moderation in eating, dedication to wakefulness. And then tomorrow evening we'll have another Q&A, so we'll pull the basket out. Feel free to fill it. And a question or two that has shown up on the board will also go in the basket, because I think it's worth sharing the answers with everyone. And then we'll talk about, in a couple of days after that, we'll talk about mindfulness and samadhi as part of this development on the path. We'll have another Q&A night. And then a couple of evenings on wisdom and insight, which, you know, covers that whole range of, really at its simplest description, sila, samadhi, and panya. So sense restraint is interesting because we might tend to cringe a little bit when we think about it, because it can feel very restrictive, and sometimes I think we can get a bit harsh, or I guess a better way to put it is that it's important to have a balance and clarity around the purpose. And so I want to talk about the reason for sense restraint, and I'm sure you know a lot of this already, all of you, but to just make sure we're all on the same page. There are really two purposes, I think, in the Buddha's teachings around sense restraint. And the first one, the most obvious one, I think, is this, you know, clear, obvious understanding that some things that we see, hear, taste, touch, smell, think, bring up incredibly strong or, you know, very challenging feelings and thoughts. Defilements, if you will, attachment, aversion, strong desire, lust, covetousness, longing, ill will, maybe all of those 10 unwholesome things, at least the grounds for those unwholesome actions, and a lot of uncomfortable feeling and things that are difficult to deal with. So that's one of the, you know, main reasons, obvious reason for sense restraint. And Ajahn Chah, you know, he established his monastery at Wapapong, close to the village where he grew up. And he did that because his mother was still living in that village. His father had passed away. And he came back to that area to establish a monastery, and she came to live there. And I don't know if you knew that, but there were nuns at that monastery from the beginning. And she was one of them. This is a pretty common thing in Thailand, that the abbot's mother takes white robes and is a nun and Meiji later in life and lives in a monastery. I mean, a couple of other women came with her. They had to be really tough. If you don't know much about it, and you, I would recommend having a look at the biography, Stillness Flowing. I think it's just an incredible account of those of Ajahn Chah's life, and give you a real sense of lots of things, of the way he lived and practiced and taught, and the Dhamma in that his life, and the way he shared that and developed a community is pretty amazing. But anyway, he established his monastery there, but when the monks go out every day on alms round, they start out from the monastery, usually when it's just starting to get light, and walk to a nearby village. And the culture is such an important part of the day for the villagers to come out to the road with their pots of rice or vegetables or whatever they want to offer, and stand and wait for the monks to go by with their alms bowls. And Ajahn Chah, and then there are little villages around, so the monks don't go to the same place every day. Different monks will go to different villages, so it's not like 20 monks descending on one village, kind of go different places. And Ajahn Chah, I've said, he didn't go to walk for alms in his home village because he still had the disease. And what he meant was seeing his family, seeing his nieces and nephews, that would stir up feelings in him and desires that he didn't want to have to deal with at that stage in his development. So it's interesting, it really speaks to knowing ourselves and knowing what's good for us to take in and what's good for us to leave alone. So there are some things that are pretty cut and dried around what we consume through our senses and what we should avoid on the extremes, at least. You know, but when it comes to certain things, it really depends on the individual and what's happening and what it means to you. Before I go on to the second purpose, I'm going to flesh this one out a little bit more, you know, in lay life, or even in monastic life, things like watching movies, you know, does that, in monastic life, of course, you're keeping these precepts of avoiding entertainment, but, and we talked a little bit earlier about how not all films are entertainment. You might not watch them for entertainment, it might be for some other reason. Sometimes it's good for us monastics to have some insight into what's happening in our culture, but we're very careful about what we might take in that way. Sometimes we run across people who in lay life develop this perception that they shouldn't even watch movies. You know, like this one lady said, she watches a movie and then she feels guilty. And that's a nice, pleasant film, nothing that's gonna kind of disturb the mind. And I think it's important not to take it that far. I mean, certainly, you know, as we mentioned the other day, there are certain things, you know, if I listen to this, that song is going to be in my head for a long time, and I really don't want it in there. I could, you know, avoid that, but that doesn't mean all music should be avoided in my life, or that all films should be avoided. We have to be careful not to become too austere with ourselves, but restrained enough. I mean, there is this tendency sometimes in religion to become harsh. I don't think any of you are going down that path, but it is something to remember that it is possible to become harsh and somehow that's connected to being really religious. And so we want to avoid that. And sense restraint's one of those things that can, you know, kind of fall into that category if we're not careful, I think, or aware. And of course, any practices like this can fall into the hazard of judging other people for what they're choosing to do. And all of us are gonna like do things once in a while that we think, yeah, that it would have been better if I hadn't done that. And even though it's very, you know, there's nothing virtual on a virtual level that's wrong. It's like, yeah, I really didn't need to do that. I could avoid that one next time. And of course, a lot of times the difficult choices are involved with other people. Am I going to watch this movie with my friend because they want to, even though there's some imagery here that I really don't want in my head? And I think it's something we really need to explore for ourselves and remember that a lot of times our choices, even though other people might not like them, it can have a real positive impact on them too, if we are conscientious and stick to what we know is better for us. Because it's so important to place the purity and peace of the mind as a very, very, very high priority. When you're walking this path, you're putting in a lot of effort, you're gaining some peace, and you want that to continue, and you want that to be consistent as much as possible, and to not compromise it, or take care of it. Now, it's not just things like images and music and film and things like that, but it's also just activities that bring up certain kinds of feelings. And, you know, sometimes what we're involved in can bring up a sense of competitiveness or jealousy or aggression even, and we want to take care of that. And of course there are the influences of our devices, our phones, our computers, and I'm sure we've all in one way or another dealt with the allure, the addictive nature of the things that we can access electronically. And, you know, finding our own way of identifying when we've had enough and where we want to put our own limits. News is a really tough one sometimes for people. And it's important to really evaluate how much do I want of this information in my mind, or does it matter? If it doesn't really have decisions that would make hinging on it, maybe it's better to know less, or at least less repetition of it. I mean, I've even seen with a couple of elder monks, especially the ones who kind of live by themselves for the most part, they get into kind of listen. You can tell they get into listening to one side of a situation a lot, and they start to get a little bit more extreme in their views politically. Of course, this can happen. If it's happening to monks, it could happen to anyone, of course. You know, like if we listen to a lot of news, depending on the source of that news, it'll have a slant one way or the other. And I've seen it go both ways, liberal and conservative. And you start to hear people repeating things that are a little bit less than true. Sometimes really less than true. But sometimes even just a little bit less. You know, a little bit exaggerated. Because one of the things that I have found happens in my mind is that there's like this primitive part of the mind, and whatever I tell it, it believes. And if it hears it often enough, it just believes it and takes it in and holds it as true. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like, if I tell myself I'm a miserable failure at something and I say it often enough, that childlike or more primitive part of my mind believes it, and my confidence goes down. It might not be based on fact at all. If I tell that part of my mind, a different story, confidence level can go up, my sense of ability. It's just an example. Have you had this experience? So if I'm listening to the news and I'm really focused on gun violence, for example, it's possible to get to the place where it feels like it's happening everywhere, all the time. And of course, we don't want to lose sight of the fact that it's horrible, that it happens anywhere, at any time. But can we hold it in, balance a context, so we don't tip over too far into the extreme? This is part of sense restraint. Am I going to listen to this story once and know that it's happening, or am I going to listen to it 8 times and get it reinforced again and again and again until I feel like every child in the country is worried about an active shooter when they go to school every day? There's a monk who actually said that to me. That's how they feel things are happening. You know, it's like, and it's a tricky thing to talk about because I can bring up so much feeling, understandably. And we'd like for this kind of information that comes through the senses to increase our compassion, to help us make wise decisions about things we can influence, to help protect the people around us, and so on, but to not drive us into a lot of fear, anger, resentment, blame. You can see what I mean. So whenever we're considering what am I taking in through the senses, We have to look at how it affects our mind, how it affects our feelings. And it's not an encouragement to block things out, to just won't listen to anything that upsets me. That's not it. And we want to be able to understand what's happening, to be aware, to be wise. It's not about hiding out through sense restraint. It's about processing things appropriately, working with our feelings, understanding our culture and society, but not taking it to a level where it goes beyond what we can actually do to help. And it carries the mind off into places that are counterproductive for our development. So I hope the sort of complexity or facets of that consideration are understood and clear. We always want, whether it's our internal environment or our external environment, we want to be able to face it, work with it, and yet keep it in perspective and always bringing the Dhamma to it so we can understand it in light of the Dhamma. And then we can support ourselves in being able to be present with dukkha. And whatever we feel, whatever our reactions may be, working with them, not suppressing them, not fueling negative mental states, but calming them and responding with wisdom. Working through our sensitivities, working through our own karma with these issues. As we're practicing, we want to be kind to ourselves. So like I said, there's always going to be that, as we try to balance, there's always going to be those instances when we go off one way or another and get a little bit too much of something, or maybe close down, close things out a bit too much. And when we find that we haven't made the decision that was the most beneficial, we want to be kind to ourselves. You don't want to, smack the puppy. You want to train it, support it in a wiser decision next time. So, in the vein of these different things that we partake of through our senses, and the idea that it depends on how it affects us, we can look at certain things and really see how we take it in makes the difference between whether we should be engaging in it or not. And one of those areas is, well, one of them is music, for example. If the music is inspiring, lifting up the heart, helping us connect more with, our beautiful states of mind and spiritual energy, that can be really helpful. And of course, it can go the other way. We were having an interesting conversation today with our practice discussion group around observing nature. Instead of always just being kind of, looking at the ground, walking here and there and not seeing, we were talking about what it's like when you really see something and you become you know, with mindfulness and clear comprehension, you become quite involved in watching some small scene in nature. And, you know, really, it's how do you do it? To be a grasp after the signs and features of sensual input in a way that stirs something up inside that's unwholesome. With nature, it's much more likely, I think, that we are able to see the Dhamma in it, the impermanence, the dukkha, the not self, that this is just what's happening all around us. And then someone gave the example of, yeah, if we're, you know, listening to the birds, and, you know, it's maybe it's uplifting, or, you know, instead of it being a distraction from our practice, it becomes part of what's bringing joy to our heart. And but then at the moment we start to analyze it, and, you know, oh, is that the red crested something or other? And I was like, do I want to look this up on my phone? And just then we probably slipped off the practice path a little bit. Thought I'd read a little bit to you from one of the poems of the enlightened monks. So Mahakasapa was the toughest of the tough monks. He was very austere. And he lived in the forest, even in this really rugged mountainous area. And he would you know, come down this mountain for alms round. And the Buddha at one point, this is in the suttas, the Buddha at one point said, Kasaba, one should come live next to where I'm living. Live here by me instead of all that climbing up the mountain every day. And you're getting old. And Kasaba's like, no, I'm sticking with this. You know, I love it, and it's good for the future generations to see someone really like live this kind of austere way. But in his verses, you really get the sense of how much he appreciated the beauty of the nature that he lived in. And I'm only going to read part of this because this is in a section of poems that have 40 verses. So I'm going to give it all to you right now. These are available online on suttacentral.net. Of course, don't go there this week. But here it says, some people almost faint trying to climb up the mountain where I live. The heir of the Buddha, the monk Kasapa, is now very old. But with mindfulness, clear awareness, and supported by his psychic powers, he climbs up the mountain. Returning from his alms round, the monk Kasapa climbs up that rocky mountain. He is freed from fear and terror. He meditates without clinging. Returning from his alms round, the monk Kasapa climbs up that rocky mountain. Among the people who are burning with defilements, he quenched himself. There he meditates without clinging. Returning from his alms round, the monk Kasapa climbs up that rocky mountain. He is free from all taints. He has done what had to be done to end suffering. He meditates without clinging. That region, spread with kareri trees, is very delightful. The trumpeting of the king elephants makes this region even more beautiful. These rocky mountains delight my heart. There the streams have beautiful, pure water. Their cool water is the color of blue clouds. In this night, the whole mountain is filled with the lights of fireflies. I really love this rocky mountain. With crags like huge clouds, like peaked roofed houses, with king elephants trumpeting that beautifies the entire region. I really love this rocky mountain. soaked with rain all the time. That region is really beautiful. Those mountains called Naga are inhabited by seers. The peacock's cry resonates throughout the area. I really love this rocky mountain. Since I practice the Dhamma, giving it top priority, maintain mindfulness well, and develop jhanas, this rocky mountain is very suitable for me. As a monk who desires well-being, and since I practice the Dhamma, giving it top priority, this rocky mountain is very suitable for me. There's a lot of such poetry in the Theragatha, the monks' verses, where they're just gushing about how beautiful nature is. And so, you know, it's really quite clear that it's not all just about looking at the ground a meter or two in front of you, but what does it do to the heart? How do I make use of this to understand the Dhamma, support our meditation, help us develop on the path? And haven't really gotten to the second purpose of sense restraint yet. It has to do with the chain of dependent origination. So I'm sure many of you, maybe most of you, have some study of the dependent origination. And I want to just talk about the part where there's contact, which of course depends upon the sense organ, like the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind, and the object, besides sounds, smells, tastes, touches, thoughts. And then the consciousness that arises to help us make sense of those connections, and then that's contact. So you see something, you know what you're seeing. And then a feeling arises because of that contact. And when the feeling arises, the next thing that comes in that chain is craving. We either crave to have it or we crave to push it away. And so this is the normal, and then it's clinging and becoming, and it goes on, it ends in suffering, culminates in suffering. So with sense restraint, the idea is that you have this contact, and the feeling comes up. This is a part of the sequence that we can't stop. And it's like when you have senses, and you've been born, you've become, you know, you're a living being, you've got senses, and you're going to take things in, and there's going to be feeling, and you can't stop that. There's no way that it just falls like dominoes. You can't put in a wedge there. But right at that point where there's feeling, we can hold that feeling and work with the feeling and not let it go into craving. And in order to give you an idea of how it works, I want to talk about a particular teaching that the Buddha gave. And it's one of the suttas we have in front of us tonight, where the Buddha taught Malankyaputta. And he actually gave this same teaching to another monk called Bahiya. And that's a story I'm going to tell you too in a minute, but we'll see how this goes looking at the sutta we have here from the Samyutta Nikaya 36.95. So at this point, you know, Venerable Malankyaputta approaches the Buddha, and he asks him, to teach him the Dhamma in brief, so that having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, he might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute. And this is a common request that you see at various points in the suttas. And people ask for this because they're going to go off into retreat and they really want to put the effort out to practice with this one piece of the Dhamma that the Buddha gives them. But at this phase, Mahalakyaputta is quite old, and he's been around a while. And I got to say, the other references to him and the suttas, he was not an easy student. He was kind of a pain in the neck. And the Buddha says to him, what should I say to the young monks when a monk like you, old, aged, burdened with years advanced in life, comes to me at the last stage and asks me for this teaching in brief? It's kind of like, where have you been all these years? And he says, yeah, I know, I'm old, aged, burdened with years advanced in life, I've come to the last stage, but please teach me the Dhamma in brief. Let the fortunate one teach me the Dhamma in brief. Perhaps I might understand the meaning of the Blessed One's statement. Perhaps I may become an heir to the Blessed One's statement. In other words, maybe this will get me enlightened. I'm really serious about this. Okay, so the Buddha says, okay. What do you think, Mahalakyaputta? Do you have any desire, lust, or affection for those forms or objects that you can cognize by the eye? So it's something you see, something that can be seen, that you have not seen, and you've never seen before, that you do not see now, and would not think might be seen. Okay, now try to imagine this. This is something you've never seen, you've never thought it could be seen. You're not seeing it now. And so he said, well, no. Like, I don't know, just now it reminds me of something my mother used to say. She really wished she could have more kids. And every time that would, I think oftentimes when that would come to her mind, she would say to me, but you can't love what you don't have. And so in a way, Mahalakyaputta is saying, well, no, I don't have any, you know, desire, lust, or affection for something I've never seen, I'm not going to see, and I don't even know what it is, you know. It's like, he's like, okay, good. It goes through the other senses in the same way, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, thoughts. Okay. So he says, okay, here, Mahalakyaputta, regarding things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized by you, so this is the stuff you really are seeing or hearing, for these things, in the seen, there will be merely the seen. In the heard, there will be merely the heard. In the sensed, there will be merely the sensed. In the cognized, there will be merely the cognized. So with a little more investigation, you can learn that this covers all the senses. Cognized covers smell and taste and so on. And that what he's saying here is just like those things you never saw or you'll never see. Even the things you see, what I want you to do is just seeing. It's not adding anything else to it. You're not adding perceptions, you're not adding any kind of like, feeling around it. You're just regarding these things, seeing, heard, sensed, cognized by you. In the seeing, there will be merely the seeing, etc. And he said, when that happens, when in the seeing, it's merely what's seen, And what's heard is merely what's heard. It's just, it's what's heard, that's it. That's it. That's where it stops. And the cognize, there will be merely the cognize. Then, Malankya Putta, you will not be, quote, by that. And what it really means is you will not be affected by that. It doesn't go anywhere. When you are not by that, then you will not be therein. You're not going to get sucked into this. It's just sight. It's just sound. It's nothing more. When you are not therein, then you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Kind of reminds me of Ajahn Chah saying, you can't go forward, you can't go back, and you can't stand still. It's a experience that we can't really quite relate to with ordinary consciousness. And he says, this itself is the end of suffering. So then Malankya Putta says, I understand this. I think this is what it means. Having seen a form with mindfulness muddled, attending to the pleasing sign, one experiences it with an infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it. So this is like the mindfulness is not clear. We're not taking it in with the mind guarded in a certain way, clear about what that thing that we're seeing really is. Many feelings flourish within, originating from the visible form. Covetousness and annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. The one who accumulates suffering this way, Ibbana is said to be far away. Having heard a sound with mindfulness muddled, or smelled an odor with mindfulness muddled, or enjoyed a taste with mindfulness muddled, or felt a contact with mindfulness muddled, or having known an object of the mind with mindfulness muddled, for one who accumulates suffering thus, in this way, Nibbana is said to be far away. When firmly mindful, one sees a form, one is not inflamed by lust for forms. One experiences it with a dispassionate mind and does not remain holding it tightly. One fares mindfully in such a way that even as one sees the form and while one undergoes a feeling, suffering is exhausted, not built up. For when dismantling suffering in this way, Nibbana is said to be close by. When firmly mindful, one hears a sound, one is not inflamed by lust for sounds. When firmly mindful, one smells an odor, one is not inflamed by lust for odors. When firmly mindful, one enjoys a taste, one is not inflamed by lust for tastes. When firmly mindful, one feels a contact, one is not inflamed by lust for contacts. When firmly mindful, one knows an object, this is an object of the mind, one is not inflamed by lust for objects. For when diminishing suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be close by. It is in such a way, Venerable Sir, that I understand in detail the meaning of what was stated by the Blessed One in brief. Good, good, Malankya Putta. It's good that you understand in detail the meaning of what was stated by me in brief. And then the Buddha repeats the whole thing, which we're not going to do. It is in such a way, Malankya Putta, that the meaning of what was stated by me in brief should be understood in detail. Then, the Venerable Malankya Putta, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Then dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Malankya Putta, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge, in this very life, entered and dwelled in that unsurpassed goal of the holy life for which the sake of which people go lately forth from the house of life into homelessness. He directly knew, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived, and what had to be done has been done. There's no more for this state of being. And the Venerable Avalokiteshvara became one of the Arahants, even though he was such a pistol before. So, think about, or as you're taking things in through the senses, see where that opportunity is for it to just stay as something seen, heard, smelled, tasted, touched, thought, and not proliferating at all, not even like if the feeling is there, then you just keep it right there. You don't take it any further, and you just see the feeling as only a feeling. It's another thing the Buddha talked about. As we develop, a feeling is just a feeling. A thought is just a thought. A perception is just a perception. And we can leave it right there. And sometimes you'll maybe even recall in your experience, or you will have an experience where you can watch this happen in your practice. I remember one day, we have a basically vegetarian monastery, but every once in a while somebody really needs to have some kind of animal food. I mean, I actually use eggs. It's not a full-on vegetarian, some lacto-ovo and stuff. But I've always had some challenges around fish ever since I was a child. Almost always, I can't keep it down if I eat fish, usually. So I haven't done that much, especially in a long time. And the smell of it also can be a bit of a problem. And you know how fish can smell sometimes, especially if it's a little old. And there was one day that they were making some fish at the monastery, and the walking into the kitchen, it just was so pungent, so strong, and I had absolutely no reaction. It was just like nothing happening. It was so interesting to see that happen. It's not like I had to try. I mean, it was, you know, like obviously something that would have caused some aversion in the past. And you'll have these experiences. So you just, when you recognize that something like that is occurring, and just take notice, you know, what is it that makes the difference? It has to do with the whole of your practice. It has to do with all of the aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path that you're practicing, and your mind is developing to a place where fewer and fewer things are triggering. Fewer and fewer things go beyond that. The seen is just the seen. Heard is just the heard. And then there'll be times when you're conversing with someone and they say something that used to, you know, have a big reaction. And I'm sure you've already experienced this to some degree. And suddenly the reaction isn't the way it used to be. Maybe there's something else that comes up that's truly wholesome. Compassion, perhaps, or kindness, or equanimity. And this practice, you know, of the Brahma-viharas is such an important component, even though it's not listed in the Noble Eightfold Path. But all of your practice coming together over time helps to bring about or support put in the causes and conditions for these kinds of experiences to occur. And the reason it's useful to identify them and talk about it is because then it solidifies in your mind. It's like whenever you see these almost, not always, but almost always, you'll see not just that the realization comes, the insight arises, but that the person acknowledges that the insight has arisen. You see it, you know it, and you solidify it. Now, again, when an insight arises, you want to be sure to take stock of it, feel the feeling, remember the feeling and the message, if you will, of the insight, what you're learning. Solidify that in your memory. Come back to it over and over again. This helps to lay in the groundwork for more insight to arise. So this idea that sense restraint protects us, all of our evaluation around what's wise to take in and what's unwise to take in is valuable practice. And then when we really can put the sense world, as if you will, into an appropriate context where we're not pushed around by it, this is a very big benefit. We've come a long way when this is happening. It's hugely beneficial. So I want to move on to moderation in the beating. And of course, a lot of the same things apply because we're required to eat. It's not like we can just forget that part of life. And I think it's really wonderful that the Buddha addressed every part of life and how it affects our mind. And because it's so fundamental to us to have food and how we relate to food, it's useful to really reflect on what am I eating and why. Why am I eating this? And also, again, to not be too strict, but not to be too lax. So there's this sweet little sutta that I wanted to share with you from the collection of suttas about King Pasenadi. So King Pasenadi was the king of Kosala, which was in the area where the Buddha lived. And he was pretty interesting. He was, he moved from being a definite disbeliever, not very interested or respectful of the Buddha, to being really, really a follower and really practicing himself. And this little sutta is a very sort of, I think, sweet little image of him and the Buddha. It's simple, but on one occasion the king of Kosala had eaten a bucket measure of rice and curries. And while he was still full, huffing and puffing, the king approached the Blessed One. He got a kind of image of the king coming up the hill and sweat rolling down, you know how it goes, and he pays homage to the Buddha and sits down to one side, and the Blessed One, having understood that King Pasenadi was full, was huffing and puffing on that occasion, he recited this verse: "When a man is always mindful, knowing moderation in the food he eats, his ailments then diminish, he ages slowly, guarding his life." Now on that occasion, the Brahmin youth Sudasana was standing behind King Pasenadi of Kosala, and the king then addressed him thus. He said, "Come here now, dear Sudasana, learn this verse from the Blessed One and recite it to me whenever I'm taking my meal. I'll then present you daily with 100 kahapanas as a perpetual grant." Hey, this kid is on it. He's gonna take it on. "Yes, sir," he says. So having learned this verse from the Buddha, whenever the king was taking his meal, this young man recited it. When a man is always mindful, he ages slowly, guarding his life. And then King Pasenadi of Kosala gradually reduced his intake of food to at most a pint pot measure of boiled rice. After a later time, when his body had become quite slim, King Pasenadi of Kosala stroked his limbs with his hand, and on that occasion, in regard to both, he uttered this inspired utterance, "The Blessed One showed compassion towards me in regard to both kinds of good, the good pertaining to the present life and that pertaining to the future life." And of course, for many of us, we can probably see how what we eat and how much we eat affects our practice, so that's the encouragement there. And then we talked at one point about sleepiness. So the dedication to wakefulness, we mentioned this sutta where Mahamudana is having a hard time staying awake while meditating. So nodding off. So I've heard at one time the Buddha sitting in the land of the Bhagas on Crocodile Hill in the Deer Park that Asakalas would. Now at that time, in the land of the Magadans, near Kalawalamputa village, Venerable Mahamogamana was nodding off while meditating. So this was early on, we were told by the commentary, it makes sense, early on in his monastic life. They even think like in the first week or two. The Buddha saw him with his clairvoyance. He was purified and superhuman, and then as easily as a strong person would extend or contract their arm, he vanished from the deer park at Vesakala's wood in the land of the Bhagas and reappeared in front of Mahamogalana near the Kalawalamutta village in the land of the Magadans. This is a common occurrence sometimes. The Buddha or some of his disciples would just vanish and reappear somewhere else. Whenever you develop that ability, please let me know. He sat on a seat spread out and said to Mahamogalana, "Are you nodding off, Mogalana? Are you nodding off?" "Yes, sir." "So, Mogalana, don't focus on or cultivate the perception that you were meditating on when you felt drowsy." So this is the first piece of advice. Change your meditation object if you're not staying awake. It's possible that you'll give up drowsiness in this way. But what if that doesn't work? Then think about and consider the teaching as you've learned and memorized it, examining it with your mind. So this is Dhamma Vicaya. This is the second factor in the seven factors of awakening, the enlightenment factors. It's Dhamma investigation. You can take a piece of the Dhamma that you've learned and really put some attention on it and investigate it. Maybe even give yourself a Dhamma talk and see if that brings up some energy. It's possible that your drowsiness will lift because of this. But if that doesn't work, then recite in detail the teachings as you've learned and memorized it. So you can take a piece of chanting or something else that you're memorizing and you can recite it. If that doesn't work, then pinch your ears and rub your limbs. I think sometimes it's translated as pulling on your earlobes. Rub your limbs, then your drowsiness might go away. If that doesn't work, get up from your seat, flush your eyes with water, look around in every direction, and look up to the stars and constellations. Of course, they were living in places where there were no lights, and you could see. We live in a place like that too. It can be beautiful. And you look up and see the stars. If that doesn't work, then focus on the perception of light in your mind, concentrating on the perception of day, regardless of whether it's night or day. So with an open and enveloped heart, develop a mind that's full of radiance. Can you imagine how to do that? It's really, you can bring light into the mind. It's amazing what the imagination can do. And just fill your mind with light. And really open the heart. And see if that takes away the drowsiness. If that doesn't work, then walk mindfully, concentrating on the perception of continuity. You're moving, you're walking, you're feeling this continuity of your movements, your faculties directed inwards, and your mind not scattered outwards. So your mindfulness is there, steady. And that might take care of your drowsiness. But if that doesn't work, then lie down in the lion's posture. Let's lie down on the right side, placing one foot on top of the other, mindful and aware, focused on the time of getting up. So that's the Buddha would say, you know, put in your mind what time you're going to wake up. And then it usually happens. In my experience, it certainly does. And when you wake up, you should get up quickly, thinking, I will not live indulging in the pleasures of sleeping, lying down, and drowsing. And that's how you should train. And I think it was, I'm trying to remember if it was Ajahn Mahabhula writing about Ajahn Mun. I think so. That every time he would wake up, he'd just pop right up. And I mean, that was like one of his determinations. He just never kind of was there stretching and stuff. Just a thought. Now, the rest of this is interesting too, because the Buddha probably had some insight into what was going on with Moggallana. So it's not always that drowsiness is about being physically tired or just kind of, you know, getting dull. It can be something underneath that needs to be looked at. He said, so you can train like this. I will not approach families with my head swollen with vanity. And what it means by approaching families is you go on alms round and you might get, you know, the people offering you requisites, and you don't walk around with a swollen head. And that's how you should train. What happens if a mendicant approaches families with a head swollen with vanity? Well, families have business to attend to, so people might not notice when the mendicant arrives. And in that case, the mendicant thinks, well, who on earth has turned this family against me? Seems like they don't like me anymore. And so because they don't get anything, they feel dismayed. Being dismayed, they become restless. Being restless, they lose restraint. And without restraint, the mind is far from immersion. So you kind of get the idea, you know, like maybe for our lives, it's something like, you know, hey, I called this person and they never called back. You know, maybe they don't like me anymore. Or maybe even getting more into the idea of what is it when we're not really being humble. We have these expectations about how things should be, and they're not that way. And that carries us down a track that leads to restlessness. And restlessness has a funny relationship with drowsiness and sloth and torpor. It's the flip side. The restlessness subsides and the sloth and torpor comes in. The sloth and torpor subsides and then the restlessness comes in. It's often a kind of flipping back and forth. And then you should train, I won't get into arguments. This is how you should train. When there's an argument, you can expect that there'll be a lot of talking. And when there's a lot of talking, people become restless. And being restless, they lose restraint. And without restraint, the mind is far from immersion. Moggallana, I don't praise all kinds of closeness, nor do I criticize all kinds of closeness. I don't praise closeness with lay people and renunciants. I do praise closeness with those lodgings that are quiet and still, far from the maddening crowd, remote from human settlements and fit for retreat. Of course, he also praised closeness, if you will, with your spiritual friends, helping each other. When he said this, Venerable Moggallana asked the Buddha, "Sir, how do you briefly define a mendicant who is freed through the end of craving, who has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate sanctuary from the yoke, the ultimate spiritual life, the ultimate goal, and is the best among devas and humans?" Once when a mendicant has heard, nothing is worth insisting on. So don't demand anything. Don't insist that it has to be this way or that way. When a mendicant has heard that, and hearing doesn't mean you just hear it. It means you really take it and you get it. You're listening at that level. When a mendicant has heard that nothing is worth insisting on, they directly know all things. Interesting. Directly knowing all things, they completely understand all things. Having completely understood all things, when they experience any kind of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, they meditate observing impermanence, dispassion, cessation, and letting go in those feelings. This is how we get to that place where the feeling is just a feeling. You'll notice these four are the same ones that the Buddha said we should investigate in Anapanasati, that fourth tetrad. So here's a way to do it. Feeling that has arisen, feeling that we're dealing with, regardless of how strong or subtle it might be, you might use it as a meditation, as a contemplation. Meditating in this way, they don't grasp at anything in the world. Not grasping, they're not anxious. Not being anxious, they personally become extinguished. I don't really like the translation of extinguished from this is the realization of Nibbana. I think it's better to not translate Nibbana. But you get the idea that completely ending all greed, hatred, and delusion. They understand rebirth is ended, the spiritual journey has been completed, what had to be done has been done, and there's no return to any state of existence. That's how I briefly define a mendicant who is freed through the ending of craving, who has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate sanctuary from the yoke, the ultimate spiritual life, the ultimate goal, and is best among devas and humans. So it's kind of interesting, I think, as we explore these ideas, there's so much in the sort of mundane realm. This is stuff we can do, we can decide, you know, want to watch that movie or not. Oh, by the way, if you want a short list of movies that are approved by the nuns, we say they're rated N. We can tell you what some of them are. It's still a pretty short list, but you know, the kind of things that inspire us to be better people, and where it's not a situation where people are breaking five precepts all over the place. And anyway, you get the idea. Well, we have these mundane situations constantly for our practice, and we can make decisions about how we want to handle them. And then You know, all of a sudden we're talking about the ultimate relief from suffering. And we might think, oh man, that's really far away. You hear so many people say, oh, I've got so much work to do. You don't know that, really. And it isn't really important to think about that. What's important is to recognize that you're going in the right direction. You're taking in the teachings that make that path apparent, and you're walking it. And, you know, regardless of how long it takes, that's a tremendous benefit. You feel, you experience the value and the improvement all along the way. And you're making a difference in the people's lives around you all along the way. And so I just, you know, want to encourage you to be willing to open the mind to the practices that the Buddha recommended, seeing that there's lots of variety. He really covered lots of situations. It's kind of guaranteed that, you know, we find ourselves in a situation the Buddha gave something that we can apply. It's so rich and doable.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.